I can use my other hand now. Wow, that was hard. Wasn't exactly, you know, accordion or anything, but listen, if this time every year, monarch caterpillars climb up on trees very strategically, find themselves on the end of a limb and even near a leaf, and they attach themselves and then meticulously weave a cocoon, a fabricated cocoon around themselves, and then they just go silent. It goes dark, they just wait. And then it seems magical to me, at least. And I've studied these things, and I know big words that are associated with it. But in the spring, after a considerable amount of struggling and fighting and wrestling, this cocoon opens itself up, and out comes this beautiful monarch butterfly, and it takes to the skies. It is amazing to me that it happens. It is magical and at least mystical. It is just this side of a miracle itself that it happens each year. But if you can just think, this creature of the ground that is not noteworthy in anything except its blandness, and it's not particularly beautiful. The colors are off, and its strategy is to what? Blend into bark. And then afterwards, it becomes this insect, this animal of the sky, and it's sleek and bright and brilliant. It's amazing. If you were to walk by in the spring and you were to see one of these little husks wiggling and writhing, and you'd stop and be amazed, and you'd see that there's a lot of fighting taking place within that cocoon. It wrestles this thing. It's wrestling inside, and it's trying to get out, and then it waits, and then it rests. And it fights again and struggles and wiggles and fights, and then it rests, and then it waits. It's excruciating to watch, it is. And rightfully so, because if this little thing doesn't get out, it won't be a butterfly, and that cocoon becomes a casket. It is literally an issue of life and death for this. And so it would be simple for anyone to walk by and see this kind of a gory thing taking place before our very eyes. Just come on. I mean, with a little bit of sympathy or compassion, you'd find yourself running back inside the house, getting a pair of tweezers, and just cracking open that cocoon to get it started, maybe opening it up to give this little thing a help. And if you did that, you would seal its fate. You would have killed that butterfly. Because the fighting and the resting, the wrestling and the waiting is part of the process of developing strength for the wings. And your intervention, no matter what motive might have inspired you, would actually be the thing that would cause those wings to come out and this butterfly to find itself in the daylight prematurely. It couldn't take to the skies. It would fall to the ground and either starve to death or more likely become food for worms and cats. But that's the story of the butterfly. It's time plus trials equals a glorious thing. Wait and struggle and wait and struggle and wait and struggle. That is the only way to fly. So it is with butterflies, and so it is with you and I in walking with faith. If you'll turn to Genesis chapter 16, I want you to see, with this metaphor in mind, I want you to see how Abraham is living by faith and having to struggle and then wait, and then struggle and then wait. And his faith grows, so does his need to wait. All followers of Jesus Christ must learn how to wait. And it's excruciating for all of us. We're taught most often from pulpits, oddly enough, that if you follow God and you hear his voice and you stand where you're supposed to and you walk in the right direction, that the doors will be open for you. And while that's true, I mean, statistically, really, the big story is that it's an anomaly that the door is opened. The real story is that you have to wait. But waiting doesn't make for good books or certainly good seminars and conferences. And so what we publicize and what we exalt are these stories of people, just these overnight successes that aren't overnight, but they just tell you the stories of opening doors, and that's not how it happens. Those are exceptions. Those aren't the norm. The norm is waiting. Faith is waiting. Let me just review very quickly. The life of Abraham. Abram literally defines faith for us, and we have found a great definition for faith is that you're living as though the promises of God are true. In other words, you've rearranged your life, your emotions, your will. Everything is a reflection of God's promises being, in fact, true. And that has all sorts of effects on all aspects of your life. And in Abram's life, the promises that God has made to him, particularly for this week, is a promise that he would have an heir, that he would have a child, that he would have particularly a son. And he receives that promise when he is 75 years old. And 10 years have passed, and he has yet to see any of that. He has waited 10 years. And now he's facing this foe of this ticking clock. A day, a month, a year, a decade, 10 years go by. And Sarah hasn't gotten any younger either. His wife is past the years of bearing children. And so waiting has kind of played its hand out, and they do not like the results. Faith is waiting. And what are you waiting on? You're waiting on the dependability of God. That's what the faith is in, is whether you can trust God to show up. You know, if faith is running out for a pass and God's going to throw it, just hold your arms out, he'll put it there, then waiting is just running and running and running. Does he have an arm for this? I mean, are we still playing? Or is he playing me? It's dealing with the trustworthiness of God. And sometimes, listen, it's as though the government itself, a communist government, works faster than God. Have you noticed that? And the greater your faith, the greater the length of time that you have to wait. I'm envious of new believers because sometimes it's quite common that they will pray these somewhat superficial and shallow prayers, and then wham, they just get them answered. More mature believers, they're praying for life and death and things of significance and consequence, and you know what they get? Waiting. And in our culture, it's not like things have changed much in the human psyche, but I mean, waiting is, we'd rather do anything than wait. We'd rather do something wrong than wait. It would be easier to do something wrong than wait. And the stronger your faith, the longer you wait. And because of that, waiting is tempting. Waiting is tempting. It's always out there to make a choice that's a bad choice, but it sure beats waiting. Look at chapter 16, verse 1 and 2. This is what Sarah and Abram are up against. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. But she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar, and she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children, so go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Let me just point out a couple things very quickly. A good study Bible will tell you this. But the first thing is that the motive of the people involved here is pure. They are trying to figure out how to do God's will. God said, "You're going to have a lineage. I apparently can't deliver that," says Sarai. And so she's looking at another way of doing it. Abram is entertaining this idea because in their ethic, they're in a dilemma. And so it has to be solved somehow. So their motive is pure. The second thing you want to see here is, culturally speaking, it's just a cultural ethic that you could have this kind of an adulterous affair and you could use a maid, literally, you could use a maid as a surrogate mother even without her permission because you owned her. I mean that you owned her. Archaeologists have dug up various tablets and scrolls that have shown kind of like a EEOC, kind of a set of standards of how to treat a maid, because they didn't want them abused. And one of the things that was okay and ethical at that time and quite common, was if you can't have children, then your mate can have the children for you. And if it gets a little dicey later, you can sell her off and keep the child. That's okay. That's part of the ethics. It's part of the way of doing things around here. And that's where they slip. They start hearing the people around them say, there's a way out of this. And waiting is tempting, and temptation just causes us to do things that we're going to regret. Patience is a virtue, but rush leads to ruin. Patience shows that we're humans. It is a target to our will, isn't it? Isn't it just an attack of the will? We see videos where we have friends, and maybe we do this in our own kitchen, where we put a dog biscuit on the nose of a bone. I mean, on the dog biscuit on the nose of a dog. The biscuit looks like a bone. Put my hand back behind my back. And then, don't. Oh, now you can get it, Fido. Oh, look. It's almost like he's human. It's like he has a will. But you remember this comic? Why dogs rarely survive shipwrecks? It says, all those in favor of eating all the food now, raise your hands. Wait. It shows faith. The stronger your faith, the more difficult your circumstances. Quite often, God is asking you to wait even longer. And that's why in James chapter 5, the writer there says this about their circumstances. He says, be patient. Look how waiting is the theme here. Be patient then, brothers, until the Lord's coming. That's how far he wants them to wait. Wait for the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield the valuable crop, and how patiently he is for the autumn and spring rains? What's he trusting? He's trusting in agriculture. He's trusting, look, in the seasons of life. Just wait, farmer. Okay, you can learn a lot from these farmers. It's a dependable thing, the autumn rains. And what happens when people grow tired of waiting? They turn on each other. They argue, they bicker, they attack the leadership generally. And so that's why in verse 8, he follows by saying, you too, be patient, stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against each other, brothers, Abraham and Sarah. Don't turn on each other now, or you'll be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Faith is waiting, and waiting is tempting. And faith is losing. Faith is losing. Fatigue makes cowards of us all. Fatigue makes cowards of all of us. And waiting wears us down. And so after waiting and waiting still more, we start hearing things that we wouldn't have heard earlier in the series. We start entertaining thoughts that we would have never considered previously. And we should know better. But we listen to the culture around us, and they're saying, hey, listen, everybody's doing it this way. It's faster, shorter, simpler, easier. And you say to yourself, and you say it out loud, are you kidding me? I can see where this leads from here. It's a short road. It's going to lead to destruction and ruin and failure. And okay, I'll do it. I'll take the job. I'll sign that contract. I'll go out with that guy. I'll do whatever. Because waiting isn't working. And I'll make a wrong choice than to choose to wait again. And so that's what they do. And I want you to see that faith is losing, and they should know better. And look at verse 2b and then 3. I want you to see that. Just look at this later on to fully appreciate it. I'll tell you what to look for now, but you got to look at it later to fully appreciate it. The narrator here has written using the verbs that are exactly the same and in the same order of the original temptation in the Garden of Eden. And so I think the emotion this is supposed to stir in us is that when after Sarai proposes this idea to Abram, and Abram agrees to it, he adds these couple sentences here, but he does it in a way for us to kind of have a flashback going, oh, no, not again. Not the Garden of Eden again. Look at the bills we had to pay for that thing. Look at the price all of civilization is having to pay for this indiscretion in that garden. Look again. I'll try to highlight it in 2B. It says, Abram agreed with Sarai. So Abram had been living in the Canaan for 10 years. Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant Hagar, gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with her, and Hagar conceived. So Sarai took and gave to her husband, and Eve took and gave to her husband, and then the world came undone. Faith is losing, and losing is paying. Losing is paying. This is predictable. We should have seen it. They should have seen it. I mean, again, look at verse 4. He slept with Hagar, and she conceived, and they lived happily ever after. No. No sooner did that happen, and when she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her boss, her mistress. So Sarai said to Abram, you are responsible for the wrong that I am suffering. I put my servant into your arms, and now she knows that she is pregnant. She despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me. This is just physics. Ethics is like physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And so, sure as life, this is the thing that's going to bring us happiness, Abram. This is the way we're going to get out of this. And look at the kind of the crescendo of the effects of this. First, Hagar despises Sarah. Now the employee looks up to the employer with contempt. And listen, this is no small matter. She has the upper hand. Proverbs chapter 30 says, and it says this in kind of a delightful way, artistically speaking. The poet there says in a grand and magnanimous way, listen to what he says about, there are under three things the earth trembles. No, there are four things that the planet cannot endure, this reversal of fortune, okay? A servant that becomes king, a fool that becomes wealthy, an unloved woman who gets married, huh? And a maidservant who despises her mistress. You want your world to come undone? You want the ground beneath you to shake? It's when your maid looks down her nose at you. Abram is in very big trouble because Hagar despises Sarai. The second thing that happens is Sarah blames Abram. Look at verse 5. And Sarah says to Abram, you are responsible for the wrong I'm suffering. All I did was I put my servant into your arms, and now that she knows she's pregnant, she despises me. Sarah blames Abram as Eve blamed Adam. And what did Adam do? Adam went passive. Where was his leadership? It was gone. It was vanquished. It was the serpent. You know, it was the woman you gave me. The woman says it was the serpent. Everybody's blaming someone because that's what happened. And as Eve blamed everything that was going on around, and Adam gets passive, Abram gets passive. He doesn't even lead. He says, oh, behold, fine. You know, what are we supposed to do? You can do whatever you want, Sarai. Do whatever you want. And so the third consequence, besides, you know, Hagar despising and Sarah blaming and Abram getting passive, now you have Hagar is mistreated. And the rest of the chapter is about her mistreatment to the point where she's just going to run for it. And in her running for it, just keep in mind, she is holding the descendant of Abraham, the father of faith. God himself intervenes and consoles her and brings her back and reconciles her. So look, let me summarize here. This moral compromise that was culturally approved, no one wins. Sarah loses respect, Abram gets passive and loses his son, and it's restored because of God, and Hagar loses a home. Hostility for generations go back to this Ishmael. The child that will be born is called Ishmael. And some of you, I know, your testimonies, your stories go like this. I have birthed a litter of Ishmaels. And you know why? Because I didn't wait. I grew impatient. I made a wrong choice instead of choosing to wait. Losing is paying, and there are bills to pay. But losing is also learning. Losing is also learning, because faith is waiting and waiting is tempting. Faith is losing, and losing is paying, and paying is part of the learning process. But here's how to learn about waiting. Here's some just keys. You can just fill these in there. Three simple ways to learn about waiting. First thing is ask for help. Ask for help. Especially at a church like this where we have multi-generations, we have so much help for that. There's got to be someone in this place that's 10 years older than you that can invest in your life to tell you about what it's worth to wait. They have stories of greatness where they waited. Or just as effective sometimes is someone saying, oh, I can't believe it. I wish I would have held on. I wish I would have endured. I wish I would have persevered. I would have a whole different life story if I'd have just waited. This church is built on a foundation of cascading wisdom from one to another to another to another. 10 years. If you don't have someone, listen, here's a homework assignment. If you don't have someone 10 years older than you that you can speak honestly to and they can speak back to you, that's your assignment for the next 3 weeks. Find, pray, beg, do what it takes to find that person in your life. Really. Ask. Here's a couple reasons. I mean, the first reason is I just said it's that they have experience. Men and women can help you not have to make every mistake yourself. Okay, you can learn and then live instead of live and then learn. The second thing is you need outside objective help to help you filter your cultural ethic. See, they made this decision on a norm that was okay for everyone else, but was not okay for a follower of God. And they didn't even know it was there. I doubt that they had much guilt attached to this, but they just had a lot of consequence. They had guilt later. Here's what I mean. After I became a Christian in college, it took me 4 years to get through with a business degree at the University of Texas, and it's extremely competitive there. It was back then, I'm sure it is now, and there were games that people played to keep the competition on its edge, and it took 4 years to get out of there in that kind of world that I lived in, and it took literally 20 years to get that ethic out of me. Didn't even know I had it. Here's an example. Okay. At the university at the time, of Texas at the time, if a professor said this, he'd say, listen, I have, there's a couple books on reserve in the library. These are the only ones on campus. You can check them out of the library or just read them there and then return them. And that's part of your assignment. A third of your test will be on the reserve material. Okay, what that means at the University of Texas in the 80s was the first guy to get those books takes them, hides them, and no one else gets to have them, and it crushes everybody else's grades and exalts him. Well, it only takes one class to figure that out, and so you've got to be there first, or you figure out whatever, you do whatever it takes. So a couple years later, okay, I'm in graduate school, I'm in seminary studying theology, okay, these are good, nice people. All right. Most of them are their undergrads are in not such competitive environments and their liberal arts degrees, and people help each other and they're friendly. So the first class, this is the truth. The first class, the professor says, and there are 3 books in the library on reserve. You can check them out, but they can't leave the library, and then you'll be tested on that. Let's close in prayer. And I thought, oh gosh, these guys are such suckers. And so while all those guys had their heads bowed and their eyes closed, I'm moving to the door. This is the truth. And he says, amen, and I'm gone for that library. I check out all 3 books, put them on the back table where I've got a little desk set up, and I am done. It wasn't soon after that someone said, hey, you can't check them all out at the same time. I just did. You know, and it's kind of, people had to sit down with me and just say, no, we're going to be working together, and we're all going to make good grades. Yeah, sure. What I'm trying to tell you is that you don't even know the cultural ethics that you carry with you because you're not objective about you and your values. And you need to ask for help for someone to come in from the outside and say, no. I know we have contracts and rules about that sort of thing, but it's still just wrong. And you need to wait. Just wait. And I'll be here to watch. You wait. Okay, another thing you do is move the finish line. Move the finish line. And that means in our heads, especially in the context of ethics and trusting God, we kind of have a deadline for a lot of the things, a lot of the values and the way we express our faith. And when we cross some sort of deadline, then we just kind of throw things up. And apparently the deadline for these two was 10 years. We will give God 10 years to help us produce a child. And they hit that finish line. And I would say to Abram and Sarai, move the finish line. Distance runners and marathon type cyclists will tell you that you don't set your finish line for the top of a crazy hill because that's too short. You push that deadline in your head, that finish line, you push it past the crest of the hill because it's after you crest it that you can finally kind of coast a little bit on a bike or not work so hard on running, and then you can regain hope. But if you put that finish line at the crest of the hill and there's just two more strokes of the pedal or three more steps, you'll give up on hope and that will be where you end. So you move your finish line back. You have this in your head already. I will be married by the time I'm 35. Well, what happens when you turn 34? Then you start looking at desperate things. Then you start hearing things that you didn't hear before. You start entertaining thoughts that you would have never done earlier in the race. Move your deadline. Move your finish line out. And then, see, imagine the worst case. Imagine the worst case, and that's twofold. One, in life circumstances and in the people. I break it out that way because I want you to see that the worst case scenario is what not a lot of people entertain, and it's usually what actually happens. Yes, you end up losing your job or the house or the place the city you're living in or whatever you are trying to save is the very thing that you lose. And more importantly, that's why I put it second, is people. Look what happens in this story. The relationships are decimated. There's contempt between the wife and her maid. There's contempt between the husband and the wife. And then the pregnant woman is gone and running for her safety and sanity. Nobody wins, relationally speaking. Nobody wins. So listen, faith is waiting. Wait. And waiting's tempting. And because of that, faith is often losing. And that's all right. I mean, you got to pay those bills and you got to learn those lessons. There's the last thing I want to leave you with. Faith is getting back up. Much of faith is getting back up. Do you know why there's so few men and women in their 70s that still follow God with a twinkle in their eyes? Because it's easier to stay down. It's easier to just lay there when you get knocked down. Look what happens in Abram's life. Remember, he had a 10-year finish line? He crossed it, and then he compromised. Look at chapter 16, verse 15, and there's a single punctuation mark that identifies his ability to get up. Verse 15 is the end of the story of this little sequel. He says, so Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son that she born. Abram was 85 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. Period. Verse 17:1. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him. There's 14 years between chapters 16 and 17. And guess what Abram did during those 14 years? He waited. He learned. He got back up. He rose to his feet and said, okay, we had a 10-year finish line. I don't know what it is, but I know what it's not. And I'm not stopping at 10. I'm going to just keep waiting. There's a crazy film from the 60s called Cool Hand Luke. Yeah, you guys have seen that one, that smirked. It is a twisted, Luke is like a twisted Christ figure in it. If you look, it's there, believe me, but it's twisted. Anyway, Luke is played by Paul Newman. He's 5'9", about 165 pounds, and it's when he's young, and has almost no body fat. And the story is Luke is doing these pranks as an act of rebellion against the establishment, and he gets caught, and he ends up being sentenced to 2 years in a work camp in somewhere in the deep south. It's Mississippi, Louisiana, it's someplace you don't want to be, certainly on a work crew. And he's in this kind of a work camp, prison kind of camp, and the head prisoner there is played by George Kennedy. If you remember that actor, that George Kennedy is 6'4". He weighs at least 225. Big, burly man. Always plays big, burly, mean men in most of his movies. Cowboy type. And George Kennedy plays this character called Dragline. And he runs the other inmates. He's the chief guy. And so Luke shows up, and one of his, you know, his character is to go against the status quo that's going on. He just doesn't go along. He's not going to fit in. And he doesn't fit in with some of the guards, but he certainly does not fit in with the men, because all the men that are prisoners there know that Dragline's in charge. Well, he doesn't play Dragline's game, won't dance to his tunes. And so there's a rule there that the boss tells them the first day they arrive. You got a problem with someone else? On Saturday, you can settle that. You put on these 20-ounce, that's huge, boxing gloves, and you put a little circle of guys around you, and you just punch it out. It's one of the opening scenes in the movie, the beginning parts of who's in charge here. And here's what happens. The 5'9", 165-pounder against the 6'4", 225-pounder, Luke has a little bit of speed. He delivers a couple punches, but they don't do much against Kennedy. And so Kennedy just pounds him, just keeps punching him. And when he punches him, he knocks him to the ground. And in a staccato way, the music is highlighted, but also the cinematography, the way it's edited, it's just Luke going down and down and down and down and down. 6 times he's knocked to the ground. 8 times he's on the ground. And then finally, one of the times when he's down on the ground, the rest of the guys don't like Luke because he's a nonconformist. They don't want him to win. And so when he's on the ground, they're feeling sorry for him after the 8th knockdown. And so one of the guys just says, Luke, just stay down, man, just stay down. And then another guy says, hey, it's not your fault. I mean, he's just too big for you. A third guy says, Luke, just let him punch you in the nose. You'll bleed everywhere, and then boss will stop it. Luke says, I don't want to scare him or anything. He gets back up, takes a couple wild swings, lands a couple, and then Dragline punches him again, knocks him down. And now people are starting to, the mood changes, the music's changed now, and the people are starting to say, Luke, just stay down. People that don't even like Luke, just stay down. He doesn't. He gets back up. A couple more swings, and Kennedy knocks him to the ground again. Now people are just disgusted. It's kind of getting gross, and they just start leaving. They don't want to see this anymore. They were excited about it. See Luke get pounded and thrashed and taught a lesson. They don't want it so much anymore. Luke gets up still again, and he gets knocked to the ground. And when he's down there, now even Kennedy's character, Dragline, says, Luke, you're beat. It's over. And Luke says, you're going to have to kill me. Now with all the sweat all over his back that's rolling in the dirt, it's become mud, and he stands up again. And he's just trying to lift his fist with these big gloves. And, I mean, it's a child. They're kitten punches at this point. But he just keeps throwing them. And then Kennedy has to do it again. He just knocks him to the ground one more time with an uppercut, lifts him up off the ground onto his back, and he seems like he's out cold. And so Dragline goes down, picks him up, throws him over his shoulder like a rag doll. He's a little boy in his arms on his shoulder. And then carefully, Dragline goes to his knees and then puts Cool Hand Luke, you know, Paul Newman, just right there. They're both on their knees facing each other. And then Luke does this. He can't lift his hands to his head, so he's just body punching him. And then Dragline just backhands him to the ground. And then he gets up again. And so at this point, there's like 7 or 8 guys left out of 20. And now Dragline can't put up with it anymore. And so Dragline just starts leaving. And as he leaves, Luke swings for him, and he misses. And then he walks by him, and he swings a left hand towards his back and just breezes him again. And then the last scene is Luke just standing in the courtyard, almost by himself. Next scene, Luke's in charge. And Dragline's doing whatever he tells him to do. He won. He won just by getting up. And the Christian life is waiting. And the Christian life is losing. And the Christian life is getting up. It's just getting up. It's getting up when other people are saying, just stay down, just stay down. And you decide, no, I'm going to get up. Faith is like in a marriage, is saying, you know what, I'm just going to wait. I'm going to wait for change. I'm not going to think the thoughts that everybody's telling me to think, and I'm not going to go there. And I got to tell you, friends, it's no secret around here, but the first 3 or 4 years of my marriage weren't good at all. And it wasn't Melinda's fault, it was mine. And she just had to wait for change. Just wait. We just celebrated 25 years, and I got to tell you, the last 9 months, you can't have that. You can't have the last 9 months without a lot of waiting. Some of you are involved in friendships, and it kind of goes sour for a while, and it's easy to just stay down and listen to the culture around you and start gossiping about a friend. It's easier to just assume the worst. You know, it gave you a bloody nose, you know? Everybody knows that. But you need to just wait. You just gotta wait. Sometimes the best healing takes place with just people waiting. Letting time pass in the Spirit of God to work. Christian life is waiting. Some of you in this church have stories of being involved in leadership in other churches, and you got panned. And you wanted to just kind of stay down. Hey, it's not your fault. You know, he's bigger than you. And it's just really easy. It's just so much easier to just stay down. Just stay down. Just stay down. Other people will do it. And it's easy to do. It is easy to do. I'm just telling you, no. Struggle, wait. That's how you catch wind. That's how you fly. And to abdicate leadership and gifts in the local church, do you know the purpose of life is to serve and lead in the local church? That is why we exist. Because the church is the means by which God is expanding his kingdom. And so I'm telling you, get back up. I just know so many stories of people that were knocked down. And you know what? Okay, so what? And I know friends and even mates are telling you, stay down, stay down. I'm telling you, get up. The Christian life is getting up. It's just standing up with your back covered in mud and the face bloody and your arms too weak to throw much of a punch, but you're still in the fight. If you quit too soon, then you're the monarch butterfly that turns a cocoon into a coffin. And the casket's laid to rest, and everybody says what might have been, could have been, should have been. And that's not how you want to be laid down. So, let me wrap it up. Faith is waiting. And faith is losing. But faith is getting back up. It's getting back up. Dear Heavenly Father, I applaud the tenacity of Abram in chapter 17, verse 1. And he was 99 years old. And I praise you for those 14 years as some kind of standard for the rest of us to follow. And I'd ask, Lord, that you would speak to us very specifically in our lives about how to apply this truth about needing to wait and persevere, how to deal with our losses, and then how to get back up and get back in this. We pray this in Jesus' holy name. Amen.